Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
I'm Andrew Kern, and you are listening to Ask Andrew, a podcast of the Searcy Institute. In the last session, I described how the pattern of the tabernacle is a pattern of revelation, even when you give a puppy to your child. In other words, it is a pattern, an archetypal form, a pattern that flows through all of existence, that everything makes itself known in this pattern. I said that because I was asked for an example. Well, I have a new question, which is this. Okay, fine, when you give a child a puppy, but we're teachers. We're talking about homeschooling. Can you give me an example from education? To which I say, sure. But before I begin, I have an announcement to make. This series of podcasts is related to a book that I'm working on and will be finishing sometime around the end of April. And so I have an invitation for you. Get ready for it. Be ready to pre-order this book. But more than that, at this summer's pre-conference in Charleston, South Carolina in July, during the Searcy pre-conference, there are a number of different presenters, and I will be one of them. And the presentation I will be giving will be a discussion of the book that I'm writing, some of which has been discussed in these podcasts. And anybody who participates in the one that I'm leading will receive a signed copy of the book and will be able to participate in the discussion. It is, as it were, a book release, and I'd love it if you could make it to that. You do not have to come to the conference to come to the pre-conference. It's a one-day sort of, let's call it a mini-conference, and we would love to see you there. So back to the question, can you give me an example from education? Well, I can, but I have to give you a warning before I do. Education as we think of it today is very different from education as the best of the classical educators thought about it. Education today is too often about names and not about things. If you listened to the last session, you might remember the bad idea that I gave you of telling your child you're going to give them a puppy and then giving them a puppet. And I compared it to your child asks for bread and you give them a stone, right? I would equate teaching people names instead of things to giving them stones instead of bread. There's a place for stones. There's a place for names. But if there's nothing being named, it's just frustrating to have to learn all the names. And so that, with that warning in place, understand that most of what we do in school is name related and therefore too often not related to reality, not related to things, even if only in the child's mind. And what we need to be doing is reconnecting the mind of the child to the real world that he was very intimately bound to until he started going to school. And so the question becomes, well, how do we show them the thing along with the name? How do we show them, in this case, let's say, the glory of a poem? And I want to address that question this way. I'm going to talk about Homer because I like Homer. And the poet Homer, who wrote the Iliad and the Odyssey, of course. And I want to use that as an example of how you can teach in the pattern of the tabernacle. Now, you might say right away, as I was going to say when I first started thinking about this, well, what is the glory of Homer? And the fact is, well, it's beyond me to say. I certainly can't take the glory of Homer and reduce it to a sentence. I will say this. First, the glory of Homer is in, I won't say this is it, but it is in the scope of what it includes. It discusses everything. And from that perspective, the second point I would make is any of Homer's glories would do. For example, the Greek poetry, I'm told, I can barely read any Greek, I kind of know the alphabet, but I'm told that the Greek poetry is colossally musical and great, and every sound, every line fits what he's talking about. So if he's writing about a storm, there's storm sounds in the line, things like that. Well, that's glorious, but it's not a glory I'm going to be able to show my students. So I need to find another glory. What is the glory that I have seen? Now, here's an important point. I don't have to predetermine, and I certainly don't need to say in words, this is the glory I'm going to show you. I don't even have to necessarily write it down for myself. I don't have to have a goal in the corner of the board that says, reveal this particular glory in Homer's Iliad. No, remember, the first principle of all this tabernacle talk is mystery, that there's something about any work of art, and there's something about any glorious thing, which is everything, there's something about anything that's beyond our knowing. And so what I'm going to do is I'm going to begin with the posture of reverence and awe toward the mystery of Homer. I'm not going to come in as an expert who can explain to you all the ins and outs and wonders of Homer. And so what I want instead of that is I want an encounter. I want to use words that Andrew Louth uses and other educators, philosophers of thought. I'm trying to remember other people who use this word specifically, but the word is engagement. What I want is for my child to engage with Homer. I don't want my child to begin with an analysis of Homer. I don't want to start by teaching the principles of Homer or how to read Homer or of Homeric poetry. I don't want to start with the elements. I want to start with a direct encounter of the glory of Homer. Now, how do I do that? Well, the best way is by reading Homer. Read together, out loud, without commentary and without interpretation. But some of you just went, oh, come on. I know, I get that, because there's one other warning or one other principle of teaching that you need to be aware of, and that is, as Hamlet put it, the readiness is all. The very first thing you need to determine if you're going to reveal a glory to your child is whether he'll be able to see it. Think, for example, of the Transfiguration when our Lord revealed his glory. He only took three apostles up the mountain with him, and he only revealed his glory in as much as they could bear it. When God reveals his glory, he always does it humbly. And I think that's the pattern we need to follow as teachers, is we only reveal to the child the amount of or the degree of or the quality of the glory of the thing we're showing them that they can handle. I mentioned earlier, I can't read Homer in the original Greek. This is depressing to me for how much I love Homer and how soon I'm going to be stepping into the grave. But I can't. There's glories that I will never be able to encounter. But there are glories I have encountered and can encounter, and there are glories I can show people. And so what I want to do is to present Homer to them and get them to engage in it to the degree of their readiness. If they're capable of reading more traditional forms, I might bring them Chapman, but they're not likely to be ready for that. They probably are going to need a modern translation. Maybe is it Emily Wilson? Maybe it's going to be possibly Lattimore. That's getting dated for people who have been born in the last 10 years. But some translation that they're capable of seeing. I need to bring together their capacity to perceive and the object of perception. Whatever I'm showing them, whether it's Homer or a science experiment, whatever I'm showing them, they need to be able to see it or I shouldn't teach. So the very, very first thing I should do is determine their readiness. Then, let's assume a relatively high degree of literacy, of experience with challenging texts even. Let's assume that the child likes reading. There's all kinds of questions that some people will have about the fact that their children might not like reading, their students might not like reading. For now, for a moment, let's set that aside. They haven't experienced the glory of reading. That's going to be a different approach. But with Homer, They're ready to read it, let's say. How am I going to present Homer for the very first time? Christians in modern culture face treacherous mountainous terrain. Biased research, ideologies, fragmented narratives converge to confuse and disorient us. Those who seek to live whole, meaningful, godly lives face a steep and challenging climb. Fortunately, living a life devoted to truth, wisdom, and goodness is not a climb that students have to prepare for alone. In pursuing a Bachelor of Arts degree in liberal arts at Gutenberg College, students become equipped for this life by reading and discussing the great books of the Western tradition. Their mentors are caring and thoughtful Christian tutors. Their guides are Plato, St. Augustine, Dostoevsky, and others who have thought carefully about how to navigate complex cultures with wisdom and integrity. In a world where college education has become narrowly limited to career success, a Gutenberg education can give you more than a job. It can give you a life. When you understand the past, you can thrive in the present and navigate the future. You can know how to care for others, serve with confidence in your vocation, and stay true to what matters most. Not only that, but at Gutenberg, you can pursue a humane education at a humane price. To find out more about how a Gutenberg education can help you cultivate wisdom that will serve you for a lifetime, visit www.gutenberg.edu. How am I going to present Homer for the very first time? Well, what I would do is I would sit in a circle. According to their confidence and readiness, I would have them read it. And while they're reading it, I wouldn't say anything. But I wouldn't have them read more than they're basically capable of following. I would have them read maybe, let's just say, 20 lines. And at the end of 20 lines, then I would pause. And I would ask them. I might ask them. I usually don't, but I might ask them, did you like it? Because it's crucial. You've got to allow students, they've got to be free people. They've got to have your permission not to like what you're reading. If you're compelling them to like it and your goal is to make them like it, I promise you that in a lot of students, you're going to undercut it by that very goal. It's not liking it that you're trying to get to, ironically. You want them to appreciate and love it, but they have to be free people or it won't happen. I couldn't, go back to the puppy. I couldn't force my child, warn them ahead of time, you have to like this puppy. I couldn't start pleading with them and say, please like this. They don't like things based on that. If they see the glory of the thing, they will like it. That's just how we work. If we don't see the glory, we don't like it. And the best way to keep a child from seeing the glory of a poem is by making sure that they're worried about a test on a quiz or some other distraction. Let them see the glory. And the glory, maybe this is a really important point. I don't think I've emphasized this anywhere near enough. You're not the one who's bringing the glory of the poem to the child. The poem is already glorious. It's coming to the child in its glory. Just like you didn't lick your child's face, if you'll forgive me. The dog did. Let Homer lick your child's face. Let Homer be the one who shines in his glory. And that means make sure they're ready and then present it. And then let them think about it and talk about it and, as it were, chew on it. Right now it's the glory of a meal instead of the glory of a puppy. But if it's a puppy, let them chew on a bone, right? Let them chew on, let them delight in, let them absorb the glory of the thing. Don't rush on to the next passage. Don't rush on to making sure they know the first book. Don't rush on to making sure you're going to get through the whole thing. No, just dwell on this thing and engage and participate in it. And how do you do that? Well, you give them questions that they're asking anyway. Like, well, how is Achilles like anybody else who loses his temper? Have you ever lost your temper? Why? How is the priest of Apollo like another priest? Have them make comparisons. Have them note how people treat each other and just sit there and observe. Ask observational attention questions. as you ask those questions, they will note things. And one of the things that one of the things that really drove me crazy as a kid in high school was one kid over there is going to notice something this kid over here didn't notice. That really bothered me because I used to think I had to understand a book completely and totally by myself. So I'd study it like that, and then I'd come to class the next day, and somebody would see other things I completely missed. Eventually, I got used to that and thought, oh, that's pretty cool. Books must be better than me. But at first, I didn't like that. But that's what you want to happen is the kids, the students, they start showing each other the glory that's in the text. Let them. Then they're seeing the radiance of the text, right? By engaging in it. As they do so, they will be appreciating it. Now, the question that arises is, well, how then does the courtyard come into this? You talked about principles. You talked about elements. Well, the courtyard is principles and the camp is elements. How does that come into it? It follows. As they appreciate Homer, you start learning principles of poetry. You might imitate and learn principles of writing. You will learn principles of life. You'll learn how to control your anger. You'll learn all those things as principles that will follow from appreciation of the poem. You'll also learn elements. You'll learn how, you know, dactylic hexameter, the way Homer wrote his poetry. You'll learn schemes and tropes and metaphors, epic similes. I mean, my favorite thing in Homer is his epic similes. No, it's not. I just love his epic similes. That wasn't there the first time I read it. I kept encountering them, being amazed by them, seeing how much glory they had. And then eventually, because I encountered over and over the glory of his epic similes, I started to treat them like something wonderful, like glories, like something wonderful. And I started to say, could I do that? And I actually wrote some really horrible epic similes from time to time in my childhood, in my younger manness. That's how you approach a poem. You spend most of your time gazing on its glory. And then what happens is the thought, the analysis, the principles and the elements, that happens efficiently and fast because it's not so boring and it's not so pointless and it's not for a test. It's to engage and encounter more deeply this poem you're already looking at. So that's an example. I know I went quickly, but it's an example of how you can encounter the glory in an academic setting, in a school, in the education setting. Again, be careful. It's not about naming things primarily. It's about knowing things. And then knowing things lets you name them rightly and makes you value the names. It's not about elements and principles and analysis first. It is about that. But later, when it flows out of the love that the student has for the poem. And finally, I recognize perfectly that this doesn't always work. I understand that. That's why you need to give them a rich variety, just like they don't always like your meals. Give them a rich variety. And when they love something, don't get in the way. Don't distract them. Let them pursue that love all the way to the elements and principles. Because if they can learn to love one single poem and one single poet or one single science concept or one single mathematical concept, everything in math and everything in science and everything in literature becomes different, becomes transformed by it. And they are transfigured and they become a more glorious version of themselves. You then become a blessing as a teacher. And God help us if we're cursing our students by undercutting their love for the things that would bless them. I'm Andrew Kern, and you've been listening to Ask Andrew.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.